This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Record drought and the Department of Agriculture. We'll hear what the secretary has to say. How many ways can you say money without actually saying money? And hey, let's have some fun out there, huh? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Let Marketplace be your guide to the modern world. Subscribe to the Marketplace Tech Report podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace podcast for Thursday, the 9th of August. Good to have you with us. And at the risk of repeating myself, man, it's hot out there. It's hot and dry, bone dry. If you go to the Department of Agriculture's website, they've got a map there of drought disaster areas. 33 states, or at least parts of them, are colored red, something like two-thirds of the country that hasn't had enough rain. That's bad for crops, it's bad for farmers, and eventually not so great for consumers either. It's a problem that lands squarely in the lap of Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack. Mr. Secretary, good to have you with us.
It's good to be with you.
So we're going to get a key crop report in the morning, corn and soybeans, I think it is. How bad is it going to be, sir?
Well, I don't think anybody knows for sure.
You don't get a sneak peek?
No. I get a chance to see this at the same time everyone else does.
All right.
And I will tell you that regardless of whatever the report says, we still won't know for sure what these yields will be until the crop's actually harvested.
We spoke to a rancher out in Missouri a couple of weeks ago, and he said he hasn't seen rain in 103-something days, and if it gets to the point where it's probably September or so, he's going to start selling off these cattle, these bulls that he's been breeding for most of his life. There are real things happening out there.
There are to livestock producers and specialty crop producers because they don't have crop insurance. What we are attempting to do for those livestock guys is to basically open up public lands, open up lands that previously were not available for hay and grazing, and make them available. We've just announced a $30 million effort to try to promote more access to water and forage.
You know, drought's one of those things, Mr. Secretary, that the rest of us farther along the food chain don't really think about until it starts showing up in prices at the grocery store. And the United Nations said this morning global food prices were up 6% last month.
Well, I think it's important to distinguish between commodity prices and food prices. What the United Nations was reporting on were commodity prices.
Yeah, which is going to hit consumers eventually, right?
That's the interesting thing about this. The farmer only gets, in the United States, only gets 14 cents of every food dollar that's spent in the grocery store. So when commodity prices go up, they can go up dramatically. In fact, they can double. And the impact on food prices is very, very marginal. We would expect to see somewhere between 0.5% to 1% increase in food inflation as a result, or food prices, as a result of the drought. 0.5% to 1% increase. We normally see 3% food inflation. We're expecting 3 to 4% next year. We'll probably likely see decline in some food prices for the short term as folks are liquidating their herds. There may be beef, poultry, and pork opportunities where prices go down just a bit.
This has been, as you know, the hottest summer on record in a lot of places in this country. Is it enough for you and the Obama administration to start rethinking food security in this country, how we plant, what we plant, how we do agriculture?
Well, we've basically seen the United States go from the 1930s where we were struggling to meet our food needs to being the largest producer or one of the largest producers of food in the world, able to meet our own needs and able to also export. We had a record year of exports last year. We're going to continue to have a strong year this year. And that's important because it provides additional job opportunities as well as additional income opportunities. You know, this is serious. I don't want to downplay it, but the level and severity of it is mitigated by things like crop insurance, by new technologies that might make the yields a little bit better than anticipated, by not having as much factored into food price increases as one might think.
At the end of the day, sir, are you still praying for rain?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Tom Vilsack, the Secretary of Agriculture. Thanks very much, sir.
Thank you.
That rancher I mentioned, Ken Lennox out of Rolla, Missouri, is his name. We're going to get him back on the show for you tomorrow, see what he has to say. There is some news of student loans today that we wanted to get to. The tendency is to think of huge piles of student debt as more of a lower income problem. And it is, of course. But the Wall Street Journal crunched the numbers and found upper middle class families have seen the biggest jump in college debt. They owe almost $33,000 on average. From the Marketplace Education Desk at WYPR in Baltimore, Marketplace's Amy Scott has that story.
Audrey Derwin is an accountant in Apple Valley, Minnesota, and a mother of two kids in college. The upper middle class family has borrowed about $80,000 to pay for it.
We wanted them to go to where they wanted to go,
regardless of the expense.
Yeah, it was important that they felt comfortable with their choice.
According to the Journal, more than a quarter of families that earn between $95,000 and $205,000 a year had college debt in 2010. That's up from about a fifth in 2007. Tamara Drought with the think tank Demos says upper-class households lost a lot of wealth in their homes and 401ks during those years. The good news, she says, is that when parents borrow the money, their kids aren't starting their adult lives under a cloud of debt.
The majority of students entering college are leaving with student loan debt, and it's students from lower-income and middle-income households that are much more likely to have to borrow to pay for their college education.
Drought says if even well-off families are objecting to the spiraling cost of tuition, colleges might have to respond. Tom Parker is dean of admission at Amherst College.
I think we may be reaching that point with indebtedness where the market just simply says, you know, we can't do this.
A recent report from student loan company Sallie Mae found that more families are weighing price when sending their kids to college. Audrey Derwin says her son left an expensive private school for community college, partly to save money. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
All right, so I'll tell you what. Why don't we all just close our eyes and not pay any attention to the stock market till, what, like after Labor Day? The way things are going, we'd never notice the difference. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. All right, so we've got a new project we're doing. It's an urban finance dictionary, and you guys are a big part of it, sending all kinds of words and definitions for gambling and stealing and nearly 101 ways to say money without really saying money. Take a listen.
Quid, ducats, sugar, bones.
Bees and honey, squids, gouda, coin.
Bank, fold, shekels, credits.
Moolah.
Buckaroos. How much does that cost? Like 50 buckaroos?
Guap. I worked overtime this week to get this guap.
Dosh. Do you want to go to that concert? I can't. Got no dosh, mate.
C-note. $100 bill. Do you have change for a C-note?
Lint.
Jack. Grease. Yaper.
As in, nothing but lint in my pocket.
G. As in, hey, can I borrow 10 G's?
Dinero. Yo no tango dinero.
Bougie. Derived from bourgeois. Enjoy your bougie $80 dinner. I'm fine with my Taco Bell.
Paper. At his new job, Kai is making paper.
Okay, first of all, my new job? I don't know. Our Urban Finance Dictionary is at marketplace.org. Links are on our Facebook and Twitter pages. Send us all the ways that you say money. We'll be right back. China's trial of the century was over today almost as quickly as it started, just 7 hours from beginning to end, for the wife of disgraced politician Bo Xilai. She is accused of murdering a British businessman. Bo Xilai himself, once a hugely powerful party chief in the southwestern city of Chongqing, was cashiered in April for violations of discipline, the party said. His legacy lives on, though, through the political machine that he built and a lot of actual things he and the party built as well. Marketplace's Rob Schmitz explains.
Scientists say the Chinese paddlefish has lived on Earth for more than 100 million years. It survived an asteroid impact thought to have killed off the dinosaurs. It lived through the Ice Age. Nothing, it seemed, could kill this animal. But then along came China's Communist Party. It built enormous dams on the Yangtze River, cutting off the paddlefish's migratory path, making it nearly impossible for the fish to reproduce. The last Chinese paddlefish was seen here on this nature reserve on the upper reaches of the Yangtze 6 years ago. Scientist Yang Bo studies the river for the Nature Conservancy.
If we worked harder to protect the fish, we might be able to restore its habitat. But if this new dam is built, we won't have a chance.
She's talking about the Xiaonanhai Dam. The dam was Bo Xilai's pet project, but now Bo's gone. Still, the government's going ahead with the dam, and that angers Wang Lida. Wang is the former head of the government bureau charged with protecting the Yangtze. He first heard about the project when Bo Xilai sent a team to try and sell him on the idea.
Economically, the project made no sense. They wanted billions for a dam that would generate relatively little electricity. Then I thought the dam might help with irrigation, but that didn't make sense either.
Wang was convinced Bo Xilai wanted to build this dam for only one reason.
This is all about GDP. This will cost $5 billion to build. It's one of the biggest investments in the history of Chongqing. Bo wanted the best GDP growth numbers in China. He wanted to make sure growth stayed over 14% annually.
Bo got what he wanted. The investment secured for the Xiaonanhai Dam helped catapult Chongqing's GDP growth to a whopping 16.4% last year.
For a long time now, the main way to get ahead as a local official in China was to produce high levels of growth and hit or exceed GDP targets.
Patrick Shivanik is a professor at Tsinghua University's School of Economics and Management. He says Bo helped fund Chongqing's investment boom by cracking down hard on what he labeled the mafia, seizing their assets, then using them as collateral to borrow money from state banks. According to former government official Wang Lida, Bo's underlings bribed a colleague of his to write a favorable report on the dam's environmental impact. And when China's Ministry of Agriculture raised objections to the dam, Wang's friends there told him Bo went straight to the top of the ministry, exerting enough pressure to change their minds. But Bo's way of operating was hardly unique among China's government officials, says Patrick Shivanik.
The party is on sort of dangerous ground in any of the charges that they level against Bo, whether it be corruption or whether it be wasteful economic policies. Because when they point the finger at Bo, they kind of end up pointing the finger at themselves.
The farm of 54-year-old Li Rongrei won't survive when the dam is built. Government officials have just measured her house to determine how much she'll be compensated after it's flooded. Tens of thousands of people will have to move out of this area.
I have no idea where I'll move, and I'm sure local officials will steal from the compensation money I'm owed. All of them are so corrupt, they just don't care about us farmers.
As for the Chinese paddlefish, its final resting place might be here. In the quiet halls of the Yangtze River Museum of Aquatic Organisms downriver in the city of Wuhan, scientist Wu Qingjiang says the Xiaonanhai Dam is one of many proposed dams he's worried about. One day soon, says Wu, the upper Yangtze will cease to be a river. It'll be a series of cascading reservoirs leading from one dam to the next.
In the short term, these dams may help develop the local economy, but if you take the long view, there are things you can never recover, like this fish. Once it's gone, it's gone.
One of many species wiped out by one of the worst predators to come along in millions of years. Ambitious government officials with a seemingly insatiable appetite for GDP growth. Reporting from Chongqing and Wuhan, I'm Rob Schmidt for Marketplace.
Coming up, yeah, sure, having fun at work is easy if you get to dance all day.
Just by moving, just by being creative, will provide that sense of fun.
But what about the rest of us? First, though, let's do the numbers. Yeah, another ho-hum day on Wall Street. The Dow Industrials dipped 10 points today, under a tenth of 1%, reached 13,165. The NASDAQ picked up 7 points, a quarter percent, 3,018. The number of the S&P 500 finished right where it started, 1,402. Among the biggest gainers was Allscripts Healthcare. Shares improved more than 18% today after the electronic health records company lifted its earnings forecast for the year. Shares of E-Trade Financial rose nearly 7% after its board dumped its CEO. Cisco Systems led all Dow components, logging an increase of more than 3% after analysts raised their recommendation for that stock. Elsewhere, shares of energy drink maker Monster Beverage scared off nearly 10% today. Seems its quarterly earnings weren't as strong as analysts had predicted. And American Express charged down 2.5%. A report showed credit card spending in July slowed to its lowest rate in 12 months. Visa down 2% on that news as well. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note up to 1.69%. It's getting up there. You're listening to Market Place.
Do you enjoy the music we play between stories? Visit the Marketplace music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. In Washington, a look at the nation's balance sheet. The Treasury Department is scheduled to release its monthly statement for July. Only 3 days of competition remain in the Olympics. Medal events tomorrow include boxing, sailing, and wrestling. And fashion designer Betsy Johnson celebrates her birthday. The purveyor of fabulous frocks turns 70. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. The small town versus big bad national retail outlet story is a familiar one by now. But what you're about to hear isn't that story. In San Fernando, California this past week, residents gathered at the local JCPenney's in protest of the store's planned departure. David Weinberg has the story of how one of the nation's oldest retail chains became an unlikely point of civic pride.
The residents of San Fernando, California like to point out that their city is actually older than Los Angeles. Located in the San Fernando Valley, 20 miles northwest of downtown LA, San Fernando's historic district is lined with quinceañera dress shops and bridal stores. This relatively quiet street is at the center of a controversy over the late July closing of the JCPenney, which has been here for 80 years.
And it's been a store that this community has supported for generations.
Al Hernandez is the city manager of San Fernando.
My parents used to love JCPenney's underwear. For some reason, they were just better than anything else.
The announcement of the closing was met with protests from locals who gathered outside the store. Facing the Verdugo Mountains that frame the city, they held up signs that said, "Don't kill our dreams," and "Ellen, be kind to San Fernando," a plea to the company's spokesperson, Ellen DeGeneres. Hometown celebrity George Lopez even weighed in via YouTube.
Okay, good people of JCPenney, I'm George Lopez. Obviously, I'm a little bit saddened of the fact that you guys have decided to close the doors, and I'm asking you to reconsider.
After the announcement, the city of San Fernando filed paperwork to make the iconic JCPenney building an historic landmark.
We received a letter from the city that we immediately forwarded on to JCPenney's.
Sev Eskenazi is the owner of the JCPenney building.
In the letter, it was very detailed. We weren't allowed to alter the exterior or remove any of the elements, including the signage.
Yes, the signage. This is when things got ugly. Sometime around midnight on Sunday, July 29th, a contractor showed up to take down the historic JCPenney sign. He had covered the name of his business, which was printed on the side of his truck, and used a towel to hide his license plate.
A resident of the community spotted this truck there with this guy up on his boom trying to take the sign down. So they raced out here. They called the police department.
City manager Al Hernandez says JCPenney hired the contractor. JCPenney did not respond to my request for an interview, but they did issue a statement saying, quote, "It's never an easy decision to close a store, and changes such as these are essential in helping us achieve our long-term goals." The effects of the store's closing are already apparent downtown.
Let me show you.
Albert Malena works at a nonprofit 3 doors down from JCPenney. He took me to the store's parking lot, shimmering in the 114-degree heat. He says it used to be filled with cars nearly every day.
I mean, when I get here in the morning or later in the afternoon, it's empty.
This is a problem for local businesses. David Jensen owns a furniture store a block away.
Since they've closed, it's been less foot traffic, bottom line. It's hurting the city. It's hurting the business owners.
Jensen says that if JCPenney can't be lured back, he expects City Hall to bring in another large retailer. Without an anchor store to draw customers, business owners say it will be tough keeping their doors open. In San Fernando, I'm David Weinberg for Marketplace.
At the risk of sounding somewhat inappropriate, this next story is more for the female listeners out there, but informative, all the same, for men. It's difficult, I'm told, for women to find jeans that look right. A near universal problem, they tell me. So Bloomingdale's is turning to technology. Their store in Palo Alto, California, has teamed up with an English company called Bodymetrics. Customers step into a booth, they get a body scan, and voila, the perfect size is suggested. Marketplace's Queen of Kim checked it out.
There's no way to start the story but with a little TMI. I've got no butt. It's as flat as a pancake. And no hips. And this has always made finding the right pair of jeans impossible.
Jeans are the hardest garment to fit. It's because shape is more important than size.
Tanya Favel is with Biometrics, the company that made the booth.
So it's about matching your shape to the jean shape.
And that leads us to the Biometrics booth. It's translucent blue and in the jeans section of Bloomies.
This is the body scan. So essentially what you do is you put your 2 feet on the footprint.
And you have to strip down to your underwear, which I did, and press a button.
Please be still.
It only takes a few seconds, and when I got out, Tani pulled out her iPad and showed me a 3D image of my body.
Here we would say your waist is subtly defined.
Well, I have no hips. That's my problem.
Exactly. So your best asset will be your legs, your slim legs. So you want to.
With this information, Tanya suggests skinny jeans. But I asked for boot cuts because I can never find a pair that make my butt look good. Back in the fitting room, I try on the boot cuts.
And this is going to be the test. These are Citizen of Humanity jeans. I don't know that I've ever tried these. I have to say, I'm actually quite impressed. And I'll open the door here so you can come in.
It still keeps a nice line on your figure.
And it actually makes me look like I've sort of got a butt.
Exactly.
How much are these jeans?
$158. They're worth it.
Maybe I can expense it. But don't tell.
I won't.
I'm Queen of Kim for Marketplace.
Happy hour.
Definitely ping pong tables.
Free lunch.
You know, I'm guessing that the more money you make, the more fun your job is.
You ever heard of anybody getting up in the morning and going to fun? No, you haven't, because we go to work. And with unemployment at 8.3% and millions of people looking for a job, does the idea of fun at work make any sense? Or is it better left to high-tech startups and kids with trust funds? Well, with that, we begin a short summer series on fun and work. Shireen Marisol Meraji kicks us off.
Bring it center and switch sides.
When you say fun, I say let's dance.
My name is Francine Geraldo. I'm a dance and fitness instructor. I teach samba, salsa.
Francine is my samba and salsa teacher, and she never looks miserable at work.
Just by moving, just by being creative, will provide that sense of fun.
Francine moved to the U.S. when she was 19 from Cali, Colombia.
Yo me voy pa Cali.
That's Oscar De Leon singing about all the wonderful things Cali has to offer. But if you're from a working-class family in Colombia, there are few opportunities to move up the income ladder. So the Geraldos came to South Carolina, and Francine's parents took factory jobs.
My mom works in a place that makes mattresses, rugs for cars. Sometimes they make Halloween costumes, different things.
And while Francine loves her work and thinks it's fun, she says her mom can't say the same.
I don't think she has fun. She complains that the work is hard. Her fingers are developing arthritis because of the work that she does.
Francine Geraldo studied kinesiology and was the first person in her family to graduate from college. She says her parents struggled so that she could come here, get educated, and have the opportunity to do fun work.
I don't remember my dad coming home and telling stories about how much fun he had at work. He basically came home, ate, and then went downstairs and did some billing.
Carl Stabe's dad was an electrician who ran the family business with help from his mom. His parents didn't graduate from college either, but Stabe did and got a degree in marketing.
I hated every job I've ever had. And because of that reason, I didn't want other people to go through that pain.
So in 2008, at the beginning of the economic meltdown, Stabe quit his well-paid job at a credit union and wrote a book called Work Happy Now. And just like Francine Geraldo, the dancer, he says having a creative outlet at work is the key to having fun.
Fun doesn't mean 24/7, you know, woo-woo.
Catherine Ziegler is a psychologist and career coach. She encourages her clients to seek meaningful and fulfilling fun work. But Ziegler says lately, her clients are not so willing to put fun first.
I do hear a lot of people say, well, I really don't like this job. It produces anxiety, but I'm afraid to leave because the economy is so bad.
Well, it's interesting, you know, especially in the middle of a recession, to be talking about fun at work.
Richard Florida is a business professor and author of The Rise of the Creative Class. He says that it may seem counterintuitive, but now is the perfect time to talk about fun at work. Florida believes we're quickly moving into a two-tiered economy made up of knowledge work and service work. He says knowledge work lends itself more easily to fun. Artists like Francine Geraldo, entrepreneurs like Carl Stabe, engineers, professors, doctors.
College-educated workers, you know, whose unemployment rate never topped 5%.
And he says that service tier, workers with a high school diploma that make $20,000 to $30,000 a year and have to work multiple jobs to make ends meet, not fun. And he argues, in the long run, encouraging that kind of cheap labor is not good for the economy.
Nurturing human talent, nurturing human beings is the key to economic advance. We can build purpose and meaning into work. And that's, you know, I wish that's the conversation we would be having in this country.
Florida says human beings are resilient. We found ways to have fun while laboring in the fields and in factories. But in an affluent society, he says, fun should mean more than whistling while we work. I'm Shireen Marisol Meraji for Marketplace.
Just whistle while you work.
Tell us whether your work is fun or not on our Facebook page.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, which is kind of amazing, in an interview with Forbes magazine, the new head of HR at Google revealed the company has started providing death benefits. So in addition to nap rooms, subsidized massages, and organic food in the cafeteria, you, or more accurately, your next of kin, will get paid half of your salary every year for 10 years. Your surviving children get $1,000 a month until they're 19 or until they're 23 if they're full-time students. And no, none of that makes up for a premature departure. But still, not so bad. All right, today the Dow off 10 points, less than a 10%. The NASDAQ up 7 points, 0.25%. The S&P 500, and right where it started, the number was 1402. John Buckley, Nancy Fargali, Stephen Gregory, George Judson, Jonathan Karp, Sylvester Monroe, Dave Shaw, Betsy Streisand, and Celeste Wesson are the Marketplace editing staff. The acting managing editor is Ethan Lindsay. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.